This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. And thank you to Julie Baxter Payer, who sat in yesterday, did a fine job. And thanks to you for supporting WRKF during the Fall Member Fest. And we start with Sean Riley, who is a former state lawmaker and is, of course, a titan of business, has the largest business as CEO of Lamar Advertising, largest business in Baton Rouge. He has been the head of seven different companies, president, chief executive officer, Lamar Advertising, and chief executive officer and director at Lamar Media Corp. And he also has a passion, going back to his political days and as a citizen, for redistricting and how we do it and whether the lines are fair in Louisiana and across the country. He is part of a group, the National Democratic Redistricting Commission. Good morning to you, Sean Riley.
Morning, Jim. Glad to be here.
And for those who'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757 is your number. And a few weeks ago, we had John Cuvee on this show, and I think less than 10% of the overall congressional delegation, we're talking about 435 seats, I think it was like 39 seats were decided by 5% or fewer votes, 5%. And all the others are usually won by routes because of the way the districts are drawn. And how do we get a better mousetrap?
Oh, that's a great question, Jim, and it's not easily answered. One strategy that I happen to believe in is to have citizen commissions actually draw the lines rather than politicians. And there's the old adage that, you know, voters should choose their politicians, not the other way around, having politicians choose their voters. And, so that's one strategy. And if you look across the country, a growing number of states have gone that route. Of course, Louisiana hasn't yet. And I'd like to see us do that because, as you mentioned, gerrymandered districts result in polarization, less competitive races, results in what I believe dysfunctionality across many of our democratic institutions. So, the stakes are high. And, of course, we're going to go through this in Louisiana in very short order. I would encourage anybody who's listening to pay attention. And
877-217-5757. I remember 25 years ago when Woody Jenkins lost narrowly to Mary Landrieu. He did carry East Baton Rouge Parish narrowly, but he did win by about 5,000 votes. But he's the last Republican of any significance to win in East Baton Rouge Parish in a competitive race. The state and the city, they've gone for Bill Clinton. They went for Barack Obama. They went for Joe Biden. And they even went for Foster Campbell over John Kennedy and Mary Landrieu over the hometown boy, Bill Cassidy. And yet the congressional district we have is represented by Republican Garrett Graves, who benefits from part of the city not even being in the district. How does that happen?
Well, it happens, again, because politicians are drawing lines that favor either their reelection or their partisan proclivities. You mentioned that, you know, East Baton Rouge Parish has historically, going back a couple of decades, been a purple place, not necessarily, you know, hard left or hard right. And what gerrymandering does is it tears asunder purple places and makes them very, very red or very, very blue. And consequently, again, you have what are, you know, uncompetitive races and highly polarized politics.
And the district that was represented by Cedric Richmond, now by Troy Carter, includes North Baton Rouge. It's basically the city of New Orleans, which winds its way up and finds a way to bring in North Baton Rouge, and that's designed to protect Garrett Graves or whoever is the Republican representing the 6th District. But Mike Wolf, my friend, he says, look, this had to be done with complicity from some Democrats because Cedric Richmond, your friend and mine, he kind of liked the way things worked for him.
Yeah, so there's partisan gerrymandering, and then there's also racial gerrymandering, and in Louisiana, the two are mixed, and they are, I think that if you drew fairer districts, There would be a delegation representing Louisiana that wasn't 5-1 in terms of R's and D's. You know, I think it would probably be, you know, more akin to, you know, maybe two Democratic districts if you decided to that you weren't going to pack the African-American voters into one district, which is what has been done. There'll be litigation around that. There is already a lawsuit around that. The Supreme Court has spoken on racial gerrymandering. It's wrong. The Supreme Court has also spoken on partisan gerrymandering, which basically they've said they don't want to get involved. So the litigation will in all likelihood revolve around racial gerrymandering.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org for Sean Riley, the president and CEO of Lamar, a company that has been in his family for a little while, and we've had him on this show talking about his company, and his brother Kevin, of course, is intricately involved, and his father, Kevin Sr., was the guy who built the company into a worldwide powerhouse, and your dad married into the firm, but for those who know, he's the reason why it's what it is today. You've made it bigger and better than even he did, but he's the one who took those incremental steps to get it to be a worldwide juggernaut, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I'm just so lucky and fortunate to have had him as a mentor. You know, he essentially taught me everything I've ever learned about business and certainly everything I needed to know about the out-of-home business. And great man.
And when he decided to do this, there was some risk. When you start taking over other companies that are being sold, probably because they're not doing as well as the people want them to, there was some significant risk in doing this.
Well, particularly back in the 80s, it was very difficult to get capital. Most of the companies that he would acquire were old line family businesses that had been around since the Depression. And you know, he would go in, he would borrow some money, he would give the selling family a note back and then give them some cash and then sort of operate his way into to fully owning it. And some of the risk was if you use a lot of bank debt, which he did in the late 80s, and then a recession comes around, which it did, then, you know, you can find yourself in a bit of a pickle. So, you know, he got himself into a few jams, but he always managed to get out of them.
And Sean Riley comes from good stock. 877-217-5757. And I know most of you want to talk about redistricting, but if you have a question about Lamar, that's fine too. Doug on Nicholson. Doug, you're on Talk Louisiana. Good morning to you. Hi, Doug.
Good morning. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Yes, in terms of the redistricting issue and specific to the congressional districts, it seemed like the previous version of that before the last time it was changed, maybe in 2013, I'm trying to remember when that was, it seemed fairer because it seemed more geographic, and maybe, you know, that's too simplistic, but having like a northwest Louisiana district, a northeast one, et cetera. And then in terms of the process we have now, though, what can we reasonably hope for to try to get a better outcome given the system we have now for deciding it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll start with what happened in 2011, which was actually after the 2010 census. That's really when gerrymandering was turbocharged, and it was really an effort undertaken by organizations with ties to the Koch brothers, and they spent millions and millions of dollars getting control of state legislatures. And after the 2010 census, the gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering, really took off. And I would trace some of the roots of our polarized politics to that effort that they embarked upon. Now you fast forward to today, and I think what's, again, most important is that people pay attention to what's going on, try to provide their input, not allow maps to be drawn in the dead of night by whoever controls the legislature. If you've been following what's been going on in Texas, that's exactly what happened there. The maps were drawn in the dead of night without a lot of public input. Likewise, it happened in North Carolina. North Carolina, I think, is the epicenter of gerrymandering. It has traditionally and still is a purple state. But if you look at their congressional delegation, there's 10 R's and 4 D's. And that's, you know, decidedly the result of hyperpartisan gerrymandering.
Now, to win a presidential election now, we're talking about $1 billion or so that's needed just to be competitive. This Koch brothers effort on the redistricting, it was done on the cheap, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. There's a famous quote from one of the brothers, I forget which one, but he said that's the best $30 million they ever spent in all of their political endeavors. Because, and that was the $30 million they spent on capturing state legislatures to take advantage of the 2010 census a decade ago.
877-217-5757. Sean Riley is with us for a bit longer, and we do have a full board of callers, and we're going to start with Nick in College Town after this quick timeout. We'll be back with more Talk Louisiana in a minute and a half. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Alondra Villarreal is producing, and we're going to go to as many callers as we can, and there is one line open, 877-217-5757. Let's begin with Nick in College Town. Nick, you're on with Sean. Hi, Nick.
Hey, good morning. You know, first of all, I want to thank Sean and his family for all that they do for the community. You know, you talk about Lamar as a corporate success, but their community involvement is really, really important to Louisiana, to the Baton Rouge region. They're very charitable, and I think all of us need to remember that when we think of Lamar and the Rileys and what they do in the community. But I do have a question about redistricting, and that is we have what we call two North Louisiana congressional districts. One of them goes from the Arkansas border all the way down the Mississippi River over to the Mississippi border in Slidell. The other one starts at the Arkansas border and comes almost all the way to Lake Charles. I'm just wondering if Sean, with all the population loss in North Louisiana, does he see a scenario where they can maintain those two North Louisiana districts?
All right.
Great question, Nick. And first of all, thanks for the kind words about Lamar and my family. That was very nice of you. You know, if we were going to draw districts that were compact, made geographical sense, didn't look like some sort of Rorschach test, then you would have one district in North Louisiana, and with the population loss, it's just hard to see two. And I would describe North Louisiana as a community of interests. I believe that if you had one district up there, the voices of Monroe and Shreveport and points in between would, I believe, be heard in a more effective fashion. So, you know, to your point, there's been population loss that will figure into it.
Mm-hmm.
But more importantly, let's draw districts that make sense.
But as we know, Congress people don't like to be driven into races against each other unless they have to, and they have to when the state loses a congressional seat, as we've done twice in the last 30 years. But like Julia Letlow and Mike Johnson would not want to be in the same race. And they'll be lobbying to keep from being in the same race.
No question about it. I'm not holding my breath. I'm only saying what I believe would be more a more sensible way to go about it.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt. And Nick's right on that. Now the population base is such that New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and Lafayette represent probably about 70-75% of the state when you factor in the metro areas. Bill on College. Bill, you're on with Sean. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. This is Bill Bryan. After the 2016 presidential election, I had so many phone calls from people just disgusted with the binary choice. They asked me to form the independent party, which I have been recognized as an official political party. And as an election law attorney, I'm involved with all the legal precepts involved in redistricting, which compactness, commonality of interest, competitiveness, and contiguity, but also, unfortunately, incumbent protection is one of the legal precepts that Louisiana recognizes. And basically, all we require is contiguity and incumbent protection. And when incumbents are drawing the districts, they obviously protect themselves. So, Sean, I really applaud you wanting to do an independent redistricting commission, which is one of the things independent parties doing. So thank you.
All right.
Well, that's a wise comment, and I think you nailed the legal legal precepts that underlying good redistricting. Unfortunately, those precepts are undermined by the politics around this, and so unfortunately, legal reasoning falls prey to the political shenanigans.
Dan downtown. Hi, Dan. You're on with Sean Riley. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, Mr. Riley, given the current makeup of the U.S. Supreme Court, won't any effort to minimize gerrymandering simply be declared to be partisan, not racial, allowing the Republicans to maintain power despite its minority status?
Yeah, as I alluded to a little earlier, the Supreme Court has basically ruled on partisan gerrymandering, and their ruling was basically, we're not going to get involved. That's basically what they said. However, if you bring a racial gerrymandering case, you know, that is on its face pretty obvious, I think you have a better chance of prevailing even with this court. I think, this court, I think, would have to take something that looks egregious and take it seriously.
Well, we have right at 30% of our state, which is African-American. And if we do the math with six congressional seats, it would the most common number would be two African-Americans, which would most likely be Democrats. Instead, we have one because most of the black people in the state are put together in one district. And it's, as we know, in New Orleans. Jerry and Gardier. Jerry, you're on with Sean Riley. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Sean, Jim. This is Jerry Hovde. Hey, I have a quick question. Hey, we've seen an effort to educate citizens like we've never before on redistricting. Organizations like the Power Coalition and Vote have been doing some wonderful, wonderful workshops to teach citizens how to use tools and to understand the whole process. My question is, Sean, if you have any recommendations on timing for engagement to optimize citizen input in this process.
A great question, Jerry. And as you mentioned, there's let me talk about the tools first, and then I'll talk about the timing. There are a lot of very effective map drawing tools out there that lay people can get their hands on and actually play around with and figure out, you know, what sort of districts, you know, they would fancy. And you can mix and match and see what makes sense. So I was encouraging people, number one, to pay attention. And number two, if you really want to get involved, there's tools out there to help you. Really sort of draw alternative maps that you could hold up and in the light of day compare it to what the politicians come up with. And there's also organizations right. that'll help you do that. I would say in terms of timing, the timing is now. As I appreciate it, the legislature is about to start a statewide tour. I don't think they're going to unveil maps, but certainly citizens can show up with maps that make sense.
And a listener, the Tom on Bluebonnet, correctly notes that I mentioned Letlow and Johnson might be thrown in the same district. When you're running for Congress, you can live anywhere in the state and run for a seat anywhere in the state. Usually you do it pretty close to home, but there was a time when Cleo Fields lived in Richard Baker's district and Richard Baker lived in Cleo Fields' district. So it does happen on occasion. Another listener notes, this is one issue that Democrats can't blame on the former president, Donald Trump. This issue was around before Trump. Now, Trump may have benefited from gerrymandering, but it's not his fault.
No. It's certainly not his fault. If you really wanted to get into the weeds on the census and how the census was conducted, you can throw some criticism around. But in terms of gerrymandering, no, it's been around since the 1700s. So, no, Donald Trump did not invent
gerrymandering. He's old, but not that old. Not
right,
that old.
Right, right, right.
David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on with Sean Riley. Good morning, sir.
To give you an example of how the Republicans will stop at nothing to deny African Americans fair representation in the Congress, Texas has gained seats under the new Senate, under the new census, and Al Green, a black Democrat, and Sheila Jackson Lee, a black Democrat, the Republican state legislature wants to combine those two districts, which would deny another black representative a seat in Congress from Texas.
That is true, by the way.
Yeah. And you know, I mentioned that that was one of the examples of let's do it under the dead of night and the cover of darkness, and then we're going to unveil it, and it'll all be sort of fait accompli. And Texas is wrestling with not only African American dilution of voting power, if you will, but also Latino. And so they absolutely gain population, but are losing minority representation.
We'll be back with some more from Sean Riley. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. We're spending a few more minutes with Sean Riley, former state representative and now part of the National Democratic Redistricting Commission. And he is passionate about the way congressional lines are drawn. And, of course, that applies also to state lines. And a listener asks, Sean, are you looking at state legislatures as well?
Sure. And at the state legislature level, it actually I hate to say it this way, but it's easier to gerrymander because you've got a lot more districts and you've got more to play with, if you will.
You got like in the House, 105 districts,
right,
as opposed to six. Yeah.
So just to go take a little walk through ancient history, I was in the legislature 30 years ago, and my first experience with legislative redistricting was after the 1990 census. And at that stage of the game, it wasn't so much a partisan effort at first. The districts made more sense going into that round. However, it was sort of the advent of what they called Section 5 preclearance, which back in that day, Louisiana had to go to the Justice Department to get all their maps approved. And there was a sort of systematic effort by the Black Caucus and the Republican delegation to begin paying a lot more attention to race as it regards right. Redistricting. And my district actually went from being, give or take, 45% African American down to about 25%. And it kind of changed the character of that district. It went from a swing sort of moderate D district to an R district after I retired.
That's the one that is now represented by Franklin Foyle. Is that, well, that's the state, that's the Senate. House district.
House district 68.
Now it's kind of, they've been configured in so many ways. You got probably two or three representatives in your old districts. Whether it's 60, what was yours?
It was 68.
68.
And it was carved up over the years.
Dr. Griffin Rogers is coming next, but we do have John on Lakeshore has been waiting very patiently, and I'll slide you in before we go to Dr. Rogers with Sean Riley. John, you're on the air. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning to both of you. I did have a question about the redistricting. I think a independent commission would be great, but I'm wondering, would some kind of maybe a starting point that took the census data and the number of districts that you have and said, okay, give me a proposal based on minimum periphery of all the districts to accomplish what has to be done in setting up that district.
All right. Thank you, John.
Well, and as I mentioned earlier, John, there are tools out there, mapping tools, that can actually allow you, John, to draw your own map. And really sort of play around with the numbers, look at what makes sense. And there's certainly going to be groups that show up with their thoughts and their maps as the legislature travels around and tries to get public input. But I'm not holding my breath that the final product that comes out of the legislature is going to look like you know, the kind of maps that, that you would draw if it was up to you, John.
Thank you, Sean Riley. Let's keep it going. I look forward to an update from you again soon, and keep up the great work with Lamar, the largest Baton Rouge-based company, and it's one that is moving upward and onward. Thank you, Sean.
Yes, yes. We've been blessed. Thanks, Jim.
My pleasure. And with us now is the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases Director, Dr. Griffin Rogers. And good morning to you, sir. Dr. Rogers?
Good morning, Mr. Engler.
Well, it's good to talk
with you.
Can you hear me? Yeah, I can. And it's National
Diabetes. Thanks for having me on your
show. It's good to be with you, sir. But National Diabetes Month, and 88 million Americans, more than one in three people, have diabetes, according to what you're telling me, or at least pre-diabetes, and most are unaware of it. Why are people unaware that they have blood sugar issues, Dr. Rogers?
Well, you know, pre-diabetes is a serious condition, and it's a condition in which your blood sugars are higher than normal, but they're not yet quite high enough to put you in the category of having frank diabetes. Oftentimes, having diabetes with those very high levels of blood sugar causes symptoms like increased thirst and urination and fatigue and other things. But if your values aren't that high over a sustained period of time, you might not have symptoms. And that's oftentimes why this 8 in 10 of those 88 million that you reference are unaware that they have prediabetes. Of course, though, if you have prediabetes, you have about a 50% chance in the next 5 to 10 years of going on to develop more serious condition diabetes.
Well, when I get my blood checked, doctor looks at my glucose level, and if it's under 100, generally that's okay. But what constitutes prediabetes?
Well, you're absolutely right. When you go into your doctor and he tells you to fast the night before and don't have anything to eat or drink that morning, that you go in and your blood sugar, your fasting blood sugar is less than 100, you're in good shape. If that number ended up being over 100 but less than 125, you're in the pre-diabetes range. Another test, though, that is more frequently or increasingly being used is what's called the A1C value. And in that particular case, you don't have to fast in order to get the blood drawn. Normally, A1C value of 5.7%, less than that is normal. If you fall in the range of 5.7 to 6.4, that's considered prediabetes. So that blood test is the test to both either the fasting or the A1C will make a diagnosis.
Now, how does the diagnosis work as far as doctors suggesting ways to keep from getting full-blown diabetes? What can be done to avert that?
Well, there's where there's good news. The good news is that you can take steps to manage the prediabetes to prevent or delay type 2 diabetes from actually occurring by consuming healthier foods and drink, for example, less sugar sweetened beverages, getting regular physical activity, and losing weight, and only a small amount of weight. Studies have indicated between 5 to 7% of weight is sufficient to largely diminish greatly your risk of going on to develop diabetes. So if you're 200 pounds, that's 10 or 14 pounds to losing it and keeping it off.
877-217-5757 is your number. In our remaining time with Dr. Griffin Rogers, he is the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Disease Director. That's NIDDK is the acronym, and this is an important topic in America, and we seem to have a problem in this country that exceeds problems in most countries. Why is that?
Well, you know, the major driver of this, you asked me earlier about having symptoms. Well, again, generally there are no symptoms, but there are risk factors that put you in a higher category of having this. If you're overweight or obese, you're at a greater risk of developing, having prediabetes and going on to develop diabetes. And I have to tell you, I'm from Louisiana, and so the number that I'm about to cite of 38.1% of people in Louisiana being considered being obese, that's ranked fourth highest among all states in the U.S. by the CDC. That's really the largest risk factor. The other risk factors are being over 45, having a relative, a parent, or a sibling who's been diagnosed with diabetes. And certainly racial and ethnic groups also tend to be at a higher risk. African-Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans, and Asian and Pacific Islanders. Obviously, those are factors that you can't change, but certainly your weight and the types of food that you eat and the amount of exercise are something that are manageable and something that you can do something about.
Mentioned by Dr. Rogers, his Louisiana background, New Orleans, but he attended Brown University for his undergraduate, graduate, and medical degrees, holds an MBA from Johns Hopkins. He's a hematologist. He's been board certified in internal medicine. And he is a guy who knows of which he talks, also an expert on research on sickle cell anemia. But I'm sure New Orleans is a city known for its food, and the weather is so hot that a lot of people don't want to get out and work out during certain times of the year. Is a city fertile for the kinds of issues that you're concerned about?
It is, and not just the state of Louisiana, but in fact, a good portion of the South as well as the Midwest. These are sections of the country that really have the highest obesity rates in the United States. And so this message we're trying to get out during November, which is Diabetes Awareness Month, is not only focusing on the 34 million Americans that have diabetes, but that 88 million Americans who are at risk of developing diabetes because of they have a condition called prediabetes. I would also point out that obesity and diabetes are major risk factors for developing, being infected with the COVID virus and suffering serious complications. And so I would encourage your listeners to consider being vaccinated if they haven't, and certainly if they're eligible, even getting a booster. This is the population that we're seeing being hospitalized, going into the ICU, and unfortunately suffering death.
Your website quickly?
Our website is niddk.nih.gov, where your listeners can get more information about prediabetes, or they can follow us on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
This is Jim Inkster. We thank Dr. Griffin Rogers for joining us. And once again, if you'd like more information about prediabetes, 88 million Americans, to go with 34 million Americans who already have full-blown diabetes, that's an alarming number. That's 122 million people. And if you go to NIDDK.org, you can find out much more. In studio is Dr. Craig Colton, the former Carl O. Sauer Professor of Geography at LSU, the author of An Unnatural Metropolis, Wresting New Orleans from Nature, and Southern Waters, The Limits to Abundance. His latest is State of Disaster, A Historical Geography of Louisiana's Land Loss Crisis. Dr. Colton received his PhD from Syracuse. He's from Minden, Louisiana, went to Tulsa University and to LSU before he went to Syracuse, and his book is out and about, and congratulations on your fine work.
Well, thank you.
It is an existential crisis we have, and it's one that as much as we talk about it, we continue to lose, what is it, a football field every...
The latest estimates are about every 100 minutes.
Every 100 minutes, so... An hour and 40 minutes, and there goes another football field from Louisiana. And over the course of a generation, we've lost what would be the size of the state of Delaware.
Something on that order, yeah.
Well, we have a plan now from CPRA, one backed by the governor, backed by John Berry, the author of Rising Tide, but not backed by the Lieutenant Governor Billy Nungesser and some others. Do we really know what we can do to avert this calamity?
Well, I think what I'm concerned about is what we're not doing that will assist the people who live in the coastal region. I think we're giving much less attention to those people. We've expended millions of dollars on researching and developing plans to restore the physical coast and to protect the physical coast. There's been no comparable effort to try to protect and restore the coastal cultures.
When you say coastal cultures, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about the groups of people who live in the coast, people, Acadians, the Isleños in St. Bernard and Plaquemines Parish, the Native Americans, and the other groups who live in the coastal region who have, most of them arrived there as a result of some tragic displacement from their homelands, the Acadians, the Isleños, the African Americans, and they've developed a remarkable resiliency and ability to persist in a perilous place.
But at some point, it becomes so perilous that the coast is lost. There is no more coast. Are we getting close to that?
I don't know that we're getting close, but we're inching towards that. we've been seeing coastal erosion, and there are impacts to coastal societies with land loss, and there's also impacts to coastal societies with the restoration planned. The big diversions that are planned will dump sediment and fresh water into Barataria Bay, for example, which will disrupt the oyster and shrimping industries there and the people who've long relied on those. But it's a slow, gradual process.
Well, we've lost so much land that we may forget that times were different not so long ago. Let's go back to 1945. You have this remarkable photo in your book, a household community in Morgan City, fishing families living aboard houseboats on the margins of the inland lakes in the lower Atchafalaya Basin. It's from Standard Oil. That was a scene that at the end of World War II was not uncommon, was it?
There were hundreds of families who lived in houseboats throughout the Atchafalaya Basin. And with the rearrangement, with the replumbing of the Atchafalaya, basically to put in the Morganza Spillway and the Atchafalaya Spillways, there's been sedimentation, and some of those big fishing lakes are now largely river deltas, and those people have migrated out. And that really disrupted the commercial fisheries.
All right, 877-217-5757, and talk at talklouisiana.org for Dr. Craig Colton, who taught at LSU for more than 20 years. His book is State of Disaster, a Historical Geography of Louisiana's Land Loss Crisis, an important book from LSU Press. And a listener asked the question that, of course, we've tried to address, and there's some conjecture, but what are the principal culprits? What's the major reason why we're in the boat we're in now?
There are many interrelated factors, many of them human-driven, certainly building of levees, which began in the 1700s, diverted sediment out into the deep gulf and prevents the delta from rebuilding itself. Gravity is at work there, so that's a natural process. The building of the various big diversions of the Bonnie Carey, the Morganza, rearrange the plumbing and contribute to the disruptions to societies and also contribute to land loss. Oil and gas extraction has accelerated sediment subsidence, as well as the dredging of canals. Those things all interact and contribute to land loss in coastal Louisiana. And now, of course, sea level rise.
How much do you think the oil and gas industry has contributed to this?
That's not really something that I address in the book. Certainly the canals have been labeled as one of the major contributing factors, and they play a role. I really haven't assessed, you know, the particulars of which processes have contributed the most to the land loss.
But you write in your book, Craig, early measurements of coastal land loss by geographers and geologists occurred as early as the 1950s, but it accelerated in the 70s and 80s, and we know those were the boom years, at least the 70s, for the oil and gas industry.
Yes, certainly. And what I'm talking about there is the effort to document land loss really accelerated. This was a process of, it was an invisible process for many years, and first noted in the late 19th century. Richard Russell in our department in the 1930s talked about it, but we really begin to see it and carefully measure it with the Tidelands controversy in the 50s, and then, of course, even more so in the 1980s, we began to really, really focus our attention on the land loss.
You mentioned the Tidelands controversy. Tell us more.
Well, of course, the first interest in Louisiana land loss was tied to the fact that it was noted that our coast was retreating inland, and that meant that our territorial waters, which defined where we could get oil revenue, were also retreating inland. So LSU, a couple of LSU scientists began trying to document the rate of retreat inland, and because they were afraid we were losing oil revenue.
And ultimately, how was that resolved?
Well, Louisiana lost out big time on that one. There was a court case, and Louisiana basically sought to have a larger territorial zone offshore, but that was not granted by the courts, and we remained allowed only 3 mile territorial water for oil revenue.
3 miles. So outside of 3 miles of the coast, which is pretty close, as we know.
Yes.
We don't get a dime.
Well, I think now there's some cost sharing from federal revenue in waters in the outer continental shelf area, but that's been a fairly recent adjustment in the process.
You note that 1912, before the big 1927 flood, there was a major flood in Morgan City then, and there were no levees or flood walls before the 27 flood. How were things able to progress under those conditions?
In Morgan City, there were modest levees, I believe, in 1912, but the Mississippi River in 1912, when it flooded, a portion of it would flow down the Atchafalaya, and that would then threaten Morgan City. People built houses a little bit higher. Without levees, the water spread, and you didn't have these really deep floods until you begin to put levees up, which confine the river and basically elevate the height of the flood.
If we do nothing, Dr. Colton, just let's say we just let nature take its course, what would happen and how quickly?
Well, that's hard to say. I'm not accustomed to predicting the future. It's a perilous thing when you're concerned with the past. But I think what all the evidence points towards is if we do nothing, and I think CPRA confirms this, that we will continue to lose land. We will have increasing flood risks from storm surge pushing further inland. Flood depths on rivers like the Amite will rise as the coast pushes inland.
And be much more vulnerable to hurricanes.
Absolutely.
Which are getting more ferocious, probably related to climate change.
So we were in a
danger zone a century ago. Now we're really in a danger zone, and it could get worse.
It could get worse. We'll see not only sea level rise and more intense storm, but heavier rainfall events like we had in 2016, which exacerbates inland flooding.
Well, Dr. Colton's a longtime resident of Louisiana. As you can hear, a dispassionate observer of this place that is under threat that we call home. And before we go call it a day for Dr. Craig Colton, whose book is State of Disaster, a Historical Geography of Louisiana's Land Loss. So, Londra, do we have time for a call? No, she's saying we do not. So we're getting close to the finish line. But we'll hopefully have you back. This is a story that all of us face. Some of us care more about it than others, but we should all be cognizant of what we're facing unless we take dramatic efforts. Are the right efforts in place to make this work?
Not entirely yet. I think we still need to think about how we accommodate the people in the coast. Can we help them relocate safely and as cultural groups to retain their cultural integrity and their communities? And I think that's one of the real shortcomings of the current master plan.
Well, from LSU Press, State of Disaster, from Dr. Craig E. Colton, thank you for joining us today. Let's do it again.
Pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place, for Alondra Villarreal. Thank you for listening. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Stay tuned.